You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, campaigning has already begun for the 2004 presidential election. Behind the speeches, progressive organizations are strategizing on how to work together to win back political power. At the Take Back America conference on June 4th in Washington, D.C., journalist and former presidential aide Bill Moyers was given the America Future Lifetime Leadership Award. He delivered a major address titled, "This Is Your Story, the Progressive Story of America. Pass It On." He outlined the history of the progressive movement in the U.S. and where the movement should go from here.
Thank you for those words, for this award, and for this occasion. I don't deserve any of it, but as George Burns said, I have arthritis, and I don't deserve that either. But I do have to ask you one question. I have to ask you, why only one award? The right wing did better than this. 2 weeks ago, I got two awards from them on one occasion here in Washington. I'm not making this up. Right here in Washington, the vast right wing conspiracy selected me for two of their annual dishonor awards, given every year to the most outrageously biased liberal journalists. I came tonight to apologize for getting only two, and to assure you that I'm going to try to do better and get three next year. I'm also ashamed to admit that I didn't work very hard for those awards. All I did was report on what I saw on Fox News. I save a lot of money watching Fox because now I don't have to buy any more comic books. I was told, by the way, that the judges agonized over whether or not to give me one or two awards. The judges were Steve Forbes, Rush Limbaugh, Robert Novak, Cal Thomas, and Luciana Goldberg, among others. I mean, being accused of bias by that crowd is like being charged with homicide by Charles Manson, Jack the Ripper, and the Boston Strangler. My first award was presented by Ann Coulter. I think it was Ann Coulter. It might have been Grover Norquist. But as Bill Bennett would put it, don't bet on it. Anyway, the good news is that I didn't have to be present in person to accept the awards. They just burned me in effigy. So you can understand what a pleasure it is to be here tonight. It's great to be with so many progressives and no one's getting arrested. Tomorrow is my 69th birthday. And I cannot imagine a better present than this award and your company. 53 years ago tomorrow, on my 16th birthday, I went to work for the daily newspaper in the small East Texas town where I grew up. It was a good place to be a cub reporter, small enough to navigate, but big enough to keep me busy and learning something every day. I soon had a stroke of luck. Some of the old-timers were out on vacation or out sick, and I got assigned to cover what came to be known as the Housewives Rebellion. 15 women in my hometown decided not to pay the Social Security withholding tax for their domestic workers. They argued that Social Security was unconstitutional, that imposing it was taxation without representation, and that, here's my favorite part, requiring us to collect the tax is no different from requiring us to collect the garbage. They hired themselves a lawyer, none other than Martin Dies, the former congressman best known or worst known for his work as head of the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 30s and 40s. He was no more effective at defending rebellious women than he was protecting against communist subversives. And eventually, the women wound up holding their noses and paying the tax. The stories I wrote for my local paper were picked up and moved on to the Associated Press wire. One day, the managing editor called me over and pointed to the AP ticker beside his desk, and moving across the wire was a notice to editors citing one Bill Moyers and the paper for the reporting we had done on the rebellion. That hooked me. And in one way or another, after a detour through seminary and then into politics and government for a spell, I've been covering the class war ever since. Those women in Marshall were not bad people. They were regulars at church. Their children were my friends. They were active in community affairs. Their husbands were pillars of the business and professional class in town. They were respectable and upstanding citizens in all. So it took me a while to figure out what had brought on that spasm of reactionary rebellion. And it came to me one day, many years later. They simply couldn't see beyond their own prerogatives. Fiercely loyal to their families, to their clubs, charities, and congregations, fiercely loyal, in other words, to their own kind, they narrowly defined membership in democracy to include only people like them. The women who washed and ironed their laundry, wiped their children's bottoms, made their husbands' beds, and cooked their family meals, these women too would grow old and frail, sick and decrepit, lose their husbands, and face the ravages of time alone, with nothing to show from their years of labor but the crease in their brow and the knots on their knuckles. So be it, it was said. Even on the distaff side of laissez-faire, security was personal, not social, and what injustice existed this side of heaven would no doubt be redeemed beyond the pearly gates. God was just once you got past Judgment Day. In one way or another, this is the oldest story in America. The struggle to determine whether we, the people, is a spiritual idea embedded in a political reality, one nation, indivisible, or merely a charade masquerading as piety and manipulated by the powerful and privileged to sustain their own way of life at the expense of others. Let me make it clear. I don't harbor any idealized notion of politics and democracy. I worked for Lyndon Johnson, remember? Nor do I romanticize the people. You should read my mail or listen to the anonymous messages left on my answering machine. And I remember the politician who said of the Texas House of Representatives, if you think these guys are bad, you should see their constituents. But there is nothing idealized or romantic about the difference between a society whose arrangements roughly serve all its citizens or one whose institutions have been converted into a stupendous fraud. That difference is often the difference between democracy and oligarchy. Democrats grew so proprietary in this town that a sterile political establishment grew so fat and complacent it couldn't recognize its own intellectual bankruptcy or see that a beltway was beginning to separate it from the rest of the country. The failure of democratic politicians and public thinkers to respond to popular discontents, to the daily lives of workers, consumers, parents, and ordinary taxpayers, allowed the conservatives to convert public concern and hostility in a crusade to resurrect social Darwinism as a moral philosophy, multinational corporations as a governing class, and the theology of markets as a transcendental belief system. As a citizen, I don't like the consequences of this crusade, but you have to respect the conservatives for their successful strategy in gaining control of American public life. Their stated and open aim is to change how our country is governed, to strip from government all of its functions except those that reward their rich and privileged benefactors. They're quite candid about it, even about their mean spirit in accomplishing it. Their leading strategist in Washington, whom I mentioned a moment ago, Grover Norquist, famously says that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it could be drowned in a bathtub. More recently, in commenting on the fiscal crisis in the States and its effect on schools and poor people, Norquist said, "I hope one of them," meaning one of the states, "goes bankrupt." So much for compassionate conservatism. But at least Norquist says what he means and means what he says. The White House pursues the same homicidal dream without saying so. Instead of shrinking down the government, they're filling the bathtub with so much debt that it floods the house, waterlogs the economy, and washes away services that have lifted millions of Americans out of destitution for decades. And what happens once the public's property has been flooded? Privatize it and sell it at a discounted rate to the corporations. I actually disagree with Barney. I don't think this is the consequence of ignorance. I think this is deliberate, intentional destruction of the United States way of governing. It is the most radical assault on the notion of one nation indivisible that has occurred in over 100 years. And I simply don't understand it, or the malice in which it is steeped. Many people are nostalgic for a golden age. These people seem sincerely to long for the Gilded Age. That I can grasp. But I can't explain the rage of the counter-revolutionaries to dismantle every last brick of the social contract. And I guess that at this advanced age, I simply have to accept the reality that the tension between haves and have-nots is built into the human psychology and into society itself. It's ever been with us. But to be frank, I'm just as puzzled as to why, with right-wing wrecking crews blasting away at social benefits once considered invulnerable, Democrats are fearful of being labeled class warriors. Why the Democrats are fearful of being labeled class warriors in a war the other side started and is winning. I truly don't get why conceding your opponent's premises and fighting on his turf isn't the sure-fire prescription for irrelevance and ultimately obsolescence. But I confess as well, my old habits still persist, but I'm not partisan. I confess as well that I don't know how to resolve the social issues that have driven wedges into liberal ranks. And I don't know how to reconfigure democratic politics to fit into an age of soundbites and policy dominated by a media oligopoly whose corporate journalists are neutered and whose right-wing apologists have no shame. So what will it take to get back in the fight? Understanding the real interests and deep opinions of the American people is the first thing. And what are they? That a Social Security card is not a private portfolio statement, but a membership state ticket in a society where we all contribute to a common treasury so that none need face the indignities of poverty and old age. That tax evasion is not a form of conserving investment capital, but a brazen abandonment of responsibility to America. That income inequality is not a sign of freedom of opportunity at work, because if it persists and grows, then unless you believe that some people are naturally born to ride and some to wear saddles, it's a sign that opportunity is less than equal. that self-interest is a great motivator for production and progress, but it is amoral, if not immoral, when not contained within the framework of community. That the rich have the right to buy all the cars they want, all the homes they want, all the vacations they want, all the gadgets and gizmos, but they do not have the right to buy more democracy than anyone else. That public services, when privatized, serve only those who can afford them and weaken the sense that we all rise and fall together as one nation, indivisible. That concentration in the production of goods may sometimes be useful and efficient, but monopoly over the dissemination of ideas is evil. That prosperity requires good wages and benefits for workers. And that our nation can no more survive as half a democracy and half an oligarchy than it could survive half slave and half free, and that keeping it from becoming all oligarchy is steady, heavy work, our work. Ideas have power, as long as they're not frozen into doctrine. But ideas need legs. Hear me. Hear me, young people. The 8-hour day, the minimum wage, the conservation of natural resources and the protection of our air, water, and land, women's rights and civil rights, free trade unions, Social Security, and a social service based on merit, all of these were launched as citizens' movements and won the endorsement of the political class only after long struggles and in the face of bitter opposition and sneering attacks by the Murdochs and DeLays, the Gingriches and Limbaughs of their day. Democracy doesn't work without citizen activism and participation, starting, as Regina said, at the community. Trickle-down politics don't work much better than trickle-down economics. Hear me. Hear me. Civilization happens because we don't leave things to other people. What's right and good doesn't come naturally. You have to stand up and argue and fight for it as if the cause depends on you. Allow yourself that conceit to believe that the flame of democracy will never go out as long as there's one candle in your hand. But 1,000 candles become a searchlight, 1,000 more a floodlight, and 1,000 more a mighty beacon in the sky. I know you have the passion, so go for it. Never mind the odds. Remember that the progressives faced worse 100-some-odd years ago. Karl Rove isn't tougher than Mark Hanna in his time. And 100 years from now, I will wager you, although I'm not like Bill Bennett, a betting man, 100 years from now, I will wager that some historian will be wondering how they let Norquist and company get away with it as long as they did. How they waged war almost unopposed on the infrastructure of social justice, on the arrangements that make life fair, on the mutual rights and responsibilities that offer opportunity, civil liberties, and a decent standard of living to the least among us. Democracy is not a lie. I first learned that from Henry Damaris Lord, that progressive journalist whose book, Wealth Against Commonwealth, laid open the Standard Oil Trust a century ago. Lord came to the conclusion that to regenerate the individual is a half-truth. The reorganization of the society, which he makes and which makes him and her, is the other half. The love of liberty, he said, became liberty in America by clothing itself in the complicated group of structures known as the government of the United States. And then he said, democracy is not a lie. There lives in the body of the commonality the unexhausted virtue and the ever-refreshing strength which can rise equal to any problems of progress. And he concluded by saying, as I do, in the hope of tapping some reserve of their power of self-help, this story is told to the people. Remember this story, the progressive story. It's your story. Go out now and pass it on.
Bill Moyers at the Take Back America Conference on June 4th. Peace Watch will air the entire speech on the 4th of July. Thanks to Free Speech TV and Eddie Becker for production assistance with that segment. Well, musicians and artists help us interpret and distill the political reality of the day. And today we bring you a discussion between Danny Schechter, the news dissector and author of Media Wars, and Polar Levine of Polarity One. Their discussion is about politics, culture, and whether music can have an impact on history.
Well, history shows that pop music has a huge impact. George M. Cohan's song Over There, you know, gave inspiration to Americans during World War I, for better or worse. And pop musicians were enlisted by the government to maintain morale during World War II, you know, which came right in the middle of the Great Depression. And it probably worked. We all know how music helped spread awareness of the insanity of the Vietnam War, and it was instrumental in changing the course of public opinion. And it charged the labor movement of the 30s and moved women to fight for equal rights. And, of course, it helped drive the civil rights movement.
Hugh Puller, how did your song 70 Versions come about?
Well, you know, I was thinking about the fantasies that people inhabit, you know, that compel them toward violent action. And those terrorists that blow themselves up in discos or, you know, fly planes into buildings are no different from the Israeli settlers who believe that by stealing people's homes that they're somehow inspiring the Messiah, you know, to come to Earth sooner rather than later. And, you know, so many Americans are so used to power and shiny stuff that we believe that we're God's very favorite little pebble in the universe, you know. So, you know, guys like Bush and Cheney feel confident that we can blow off the rest of the world and pick our fights based on, you know, who's got the oil we need.
Can dissent really have an impact now that the mainstream media is so totally ruled by mega corporations? How can today's public apathy be breached?
Well, when culture is disseminated for the purpose of generating cash flow, you know, an apathetic public is a natural result, you know, and probably the intended result. You know, the only positive thing about war is that people suddenly are visited by reality, you know, and Michael Jackson's nose becomes less consequential. You know, if people have been trained to crave light entertainment 24/7, it's hard to break through that. You know, maybe it takes their friends coming home in body bags to get them to shut down the Nintendo for a while and, you know, maybe pick up a newspaper.
Considering the massive amount of disinformation that the Bush administration delivers every day through a very compliant press and the grip that bottom-line values have on the arts, do you feel pessimistic about your role as a politically conscious artist?
I'm pissed, yeah, but, you know, pessimistic? I mean, not at all. You know, Polarity One, along with the clear political stance, you know, we're a big groove machine. Our groove science takes in funk and hip-hop and soukous, zouk, you know, samba, you name it. You know, the whole rhythm section has studied this stuff and has worked with guys like Salif Keita, Vernon Reed, De La Soul, you know, all kinds of salsa bands and samba bands, you know, and I don't mean just that we have a conga player in the band, you know. It's like if you study rhythm like studying science or law, you know, it changes the way you hear music and view the world you live in. You know, if you don't know the difference between a Rio samba or a Bahian samba or a Wawanko from a mambo, then you can't cut it in our band. You know, people from all over the world and all ages know a groove when they hear one. You know, you don't have to know where it came from. You know, but their bodies can tell the difference between a groove and a, you know, a loud pulse. that's the sugar pill we offer that holds the political messages. You know, my friends, the Pakistani rock band Janoon were invited to perform at the UN General Assembly because they're known for putting their careers on the line, spreading a message for peace. In Pakistan and India, they're multi-platinum superstars, but in America, you know, they're not well known yet. But every place they play in America is packed full, mainly with South Asians and increasingly more Americans. And, you know, that doesn't sound so impressive, but consider this, you know, those South Asians are both Pakistanis and Indians, and back home they're ready to incinerate each other with nukes. But at the concerts here and in India, they dance together, you know, singing along with Janoon's songs in Urdu and Punjabi. You know, how could I be pessimistic when I see that, you know?
So many political songs are basically bumper stickers with musical accompaniment. Too often they sound preachy and naive. Are artists just timid, or is the topical song no longer relevant in today's media world?
Well, you know, good songwriters write good songs, and trite songwriters write trite songs. And I think we write well about what we know about. Most political songs are trite because the writer's not really informed, you know, in a deep and nuanced way about the issues. So, you know, the songs are not much more than slogans or some generalized, you know, let's all just love each other, you know, we are the world type thing. You just can't write a decent topical song without a deep understanding of the topic and, you know, some intellectual background in history and politics and in some compelling sense that you can bring some light to an issue that's shrouded in political double talk and superstition. You know, Bono can distill a lot of information, you know, just in one line, like one more in the name of love to describe the sacrifices that certain individuals were called to make. Springsteen wrote a gigantic book, you know, in his My Hometown. Dylan's With God on Our Side threw a monkey wrench into that whole insane nationalistic testosterone rush that pushes creeps like Bush into warmongering.
Polar Levine of Polarity One and Danny Schechter. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer today was Laurel Padgett-Seekins. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Eddie Becker, Jim Bennett, and Otto Hammett. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.